I'm Joshua Bear for 91.3 WUKY, and welcome to our podcast. This is an archive episode of Curtains at 8 from November 2007, featuring Nick Lawrence with guests Arlo Guthrie, UK Symphony Director John Nardalillo, and a special appearance by former Lexington Mayor Jim Newberry. Enjoy.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Curtains at 8. I'm Nick Lawrence. Pleased to be here with you, and pleased also with the nobility, royalty, and stardom that you're going to witness here in the next few minutes on Curtains at 8. First of all, John Nardalillo is here with us. John is the maestro for the UK Symphony Orchestra, and John has a special project going on, which I will ask him to introduce.
Thanks, Nick. Tomorrow night, Friday night, we'll be at the Singletary Center with the UK Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
And our very, very special guest, Arlo Guthrie, will be singing and playing with us.
What, he's back again?
Arlo's back again.
Arlo, how are you?
I'm back again.
Back again. Welcome back to Kentucky.
So far, so good.
I think that's recidivism, isn't it? Can't stay away.
Yeah, the repeat offender.
You and John have been hanging out for a long time.
We have. We've been actually working on this project for about 8 years.
Yeah?
It's been going on a while.
Have you about got it down?
I think so. The different shows that we've done over the years, I knew John before he was here in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And we'd been doing these orchestra shows around the country, and we recorded a few of them over the years, and none of them actually worked out quite right. You get one guy up on the stage, me,
yeah,
getting through 2 hours without making a mistake, the chances are fairly slim. You put another guy or two up there in a little band, the chances diminish.
Yeah.
You put 60 people on the freaking stage.
No telling what can happen.
It's just not going to happen. So we recorded it over the years, and last June, when is it? When do we record this thing?
March
of 06. I came down here and played with the orchestra, and we happened to hit one of them perfect storms. The night went great. We had a great recording engineer in there. The orchestra played great. I was in good form. The audience was fabulous. New victims for me. And we got it all. We got it all on tape and put out a record. Her brothers and her sisters are out through for tonight, pretending that they've just come into power. Oh, but she, for most of all, knows that they can only fall in my darkest hour.
And are you going to sort of replicate the previous concert, or are you going to make up something new and fresh?
Probably some parts of both. I think
well, some of your big hits and stuff you've got to do. Are you going to do Alice, by the way?
I have no idea.
Maybe?
There's no set program.
No, really?
It's a free-for-all. That's what I'm saying. It's going to be fun this time.
But you got to tell these orchestra people what they got to play.
Well, they didn't orchestrate Alice, thank God. I mean, imagine, when we set out to put music to these songs, certain songs are better than others to orchestrate. For example, I Don't Want a Pickle would not be my first choice of a song to sit down with 60 people to play. So there were some songs we just didn't do in that vein. And we picked the more moody ones, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, if you did Alice, you'd have to have 60 players on stage and then 60 players to come replace them when they wear out.
That's right.
How long is Alice?
It's about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Actually, it's exactly the same length as the gap in the Watergate tape.
Oh, 18 minutes?
18 minutes and 20 seconds.
Is that what Nixon really had on the tape?
I'm just telling you what the truth is. Now, I don't know. I'm not making the connections.
The inference is up to the listener.
Although I was told by Chip Carter, who was the president's son at the time when I met him, that the Alice record was indeed in the Nixon library.
I'll be darned. And so would he.
It's just getting murkier and murkier.
It is, it is. Perhaps we need an investigation.
Well, I'm just leaving it at this because, frankly, it just works perfectly for me.
By golly, it makes you kind of political, too, doesn't it?
It makes me historic.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to think about that for a second.
All right.
Radio stations wouldn't play it. It was too long.
Well, in the days that it came out, radio stations didn't play anything over 2.5 minutes. I mean, if it was 2:31, they wouldn't touch it.
But that's before NPR. We could play the whole dang thing if we wanted to, Arlo.
You can?
Yeah.
But would you?
I would. Yeah, but
I should have brought my guitar.
Well,
I wouldn't have had to think this morning.
I'll go down the hall and borrow one. One of the guys here plays. He's got a little Marco Polo.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we might do it at the show. I mean, I don't know. It sort of depends on how the night goes.
Yeah.
What the audience is like. It's nice having a sort of free-for-all, not having every little thing planned out.
Yeah, but that sometimes bothers orchestra conductors.
That's part of the fun, isn't it?
They like to be, they're kind of literal, Arlo, you know, sort of controlling.
They tend to be, but it's, you know.
But it works out pretty good.
When I first started this project with John, I was calling it Arlo versus the Orchestra. And I was calling it that for good reason. I mean, a student orchestra is one thing in the university, but when we would take this to professional symphonies
You did this with Keith Lockhart and the Pops?
That's what I'm saying. When they see me coming, they're going, oh, man, you know, the orchestra is going, what is that? You know, and so it gets kind of iffy.
Uh-huh.
It takes a while to...
But the union players, they've got to sit there and saw anyway, right?
Well, you just got to, you know, you got to lead them around the rink, as it were, for a while.
Yeah, now, tell the truth. Do you read music?
Sure.
Does it interfere with your playing?
I don't let it. I read so slowly that it doesn't matter.
That's pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good.
I had to take piano lessons when I was a kid, and I had to study theory when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I was brought up in the classical world also, you know, aside from back porch picking.
Yeah. Did you have that big red book, John Williams, Teaching Little Fingers to Play? Yeah, I remember From a Wigwam in the Back, that Indian song?
You know what? I remember the picture, but I don't remember the piece.
Well, we'll get John Nardalillo to direct it, and we'll get the whole orchestra in on it.
All right.
It's in C minor.
C minor, we can do that.
Okay. If it's C sharp minor, it gets to be Beethoven, right?
Right.
You guys just did Beethoven not long ago.
We just did Beethoven 5.
Yeah.
And on this concert, we're also going to be doing the one on Friday night. We're also going to be doing Appalachian Spring,
the great Aaron Copland
piece. And one of the reasons we're going to be doing that is that Arlo's mother was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company and danced in the premiere of the piece in 1944.
In the very premiere?
In the very premiere in Washington, D.C.
Well, there's another tie, too, John, another observation, anyway. Classical forces, violins, violas, celli, and all that sort of good stuff on stage, and you expect to have Beethoven, you expect to have Mozart. But during their time, in Brahms' time, they were making a living orchestrating folk music.
Well, all the great classical music is folk music. I mean, it's the classical composers all used the folk music of their time and their country and their culture when they wrote their pieces. It's all the same music.
And that's what we're doing right here.
Okay.
Some of the tunes that you do with the orchestra, City of New Orleans.
We do City of New Orleans.
Darkest
Hour. We have a great arrangement of Arlo's dad's song, This Land Is Your Land. We do an old version of the Weavers, Gordon Jenkins, Good Night Irene.
I love that.
Yeah, there's some wonderful stuff on there.
I've got an old 33 with Lead Belly doing Irene, the way it's supposed to be done, not how it's been done subsequently. Also, Ronnie Gilbert and I have an intermediate friend, Sam Orth, who was a guitar student of mine long, long, long time ago in a country far, far away. But he's a good friend of Ronnie's, and we communicated back and forth several times. She's really
Still hanging in there.
She's still
there.
Now, Lee's dead?
Yeah, Lee's gone, yeah. But the rest of them are fine.
I was just talking to Pete Seeger last
couple of weeks ago on the phone. He's 80-something. He's out chopping wood and ice skating and stuff like that.
Playing the banjo still?
Absolutely.
Oh, man, sounds good. His I guess, half-brother, Mike, has been through here a couple of times on Curtains at 8, and I really, really love the guy. He is so terrific. He knows his stuff.
He's not just a great player, but he's a great historian and scholar on this stuff. You know, he really walks around with a banjo that could have been made 200 years ago and can play that as well as the latest, greatest stuff.
Yeah, he didn't even get frets put on it.
Yeah.
It's one of those, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're honored also here this evening to have on Curtains at 8 not only Arlo Guthrie and John Nardalillo, we have with us the mayor of Lexington, Jim Newberry. Jim, welcome to Curtains at 8.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to see you again. Well, we're pleased to have Arlo here, and I think you've got a little something that you have up your sleeve, so to speak, for Arlo.
I do. We are delighted to have Arlo back in Lexington. It is a real honor for both the university and for our city to have him here with us, and I know that he and John have had a long-standing relationship that is now working to the benefit of our community and our university. And so I am very pleased to present a key to the city to Mr. Guthrie.
Wow.
And
a key to the city?
A key to the city. So next time you won't have to use John's to get in.
Man, I love that.
You'll have your own.
I love it.
And we also want to present a little proclamation to John to recognize his accomplishments and those of the UK Symphony Orchestra. I have become a fan of the symphony since John has been here. I remember attending one of their concerts fairly soon after John arrived, and I was thinking, well, I'll suffer through this.
Mm-hmm. And, I can share that thought.
I had never heard the orchestra under John's direction until that evening. And the first note that came out, my head was out of my program, and he had my attention for the rest of the evening. They were fabulous. And since then, I have a couple of their CDs that I enjoy immensely, and they do a great job. So,
thank you so much.
Let me read the proclamation so that you'll have it. And so everyone will be aware of its contents. Whereas the University of Kentucky Symphony Orchestra, comprised of the finest string, wind, and percussion instrumentalists from both the graduate and undergraduate programs, has been an integral part of the cultural life of UK and the Lexington community. And whereas the orchestra's conductor, John Nardalillo, has conducted at the Kennedy Center, Carnegie Hall, and Philadelphia's Kimmel Center, and is the founder and music director of the Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C. And whereas, with the strength of the talented student musicians at the University of Kentucky, the UK Symphony Orchestra has become one of only a few college orchestras in the nation, even the world, to have signed a recording contract with Naxos, the world's largest classical label. And whereas the orchestra has made two recordings, Music of the Horse, in 2006, in collaboration with Keeneland, and in times like these, featuring Arlo Guthrie and his music. Student musicians will perform with Arlo Guthrie in Carnegie Hall on November 24th. Now, therefore, I, Jim Newberry, mayor of the Lexington Fayette Urban County Government, do hereby proclaim November 2007 as UK's Symphony Orchestra Month. So congratulations, John.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's wonderful. I thought we might get a day, but a whole month.
A whole month. It's a tremendous honor for the university, for the members of the orchestra, and certainly for you, Arlo, and John. We're delighted for you and wish you nothing but the very best.
Thank you so much. You know, it's wonderful to have the support of the community here in Lexington, and I know the students feel that and feel that they really are part of the artistic life of the community and take that seriously and are proud of that.
And I love to show it off. I have periodically guests from a lot of different places around the country and periodically from around the world, and I've made a habit of sharing with them the Music of the Horse. And it's a fun way to trumpet both our affinity for the horse and our affinity for the great musicians on campus.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a treat to have you here, Mayor, to make the presentation, and it's a treat to have you here, Arlo. I'm very honored to have your presence here. I have lived with your father's works and now your works, and it's one treasure after another in that case. And John Nardalillo, you're a great, great asset for the community of Lexington. Okay, sounds good. Now you've got to head out someplace else. Where are you headed, Jim?
Back to the office.
Work never ceases.
It's a pretty interesting job, and there's always something to keep me occupied.
Do you ever get time for a little power nap?
Usually between midnight and 4 a.m.
Well, don't rush into it.
I'll do my best.
I want to thank you very much for being a part of Curtin's Date.
Great to be here.
Mayor, nice to meet you, and thank you so much for the key to the city. I think that's great.
You're more than welcome.
And, John, you got 30 days. I hope you get out early, maybe on good behavior or something.
Right.
John Nardalillo here, the director, the music director of and conductor of the University of Kentucky Symphony Orchestra. And our special guest, Arlo Guthrie. Arlo, it's a marvelous moment to have you here in Curtains at 8. I hope you're having a good time.
Yeah.
Are we keeping you awake or anything like that?
You know what? I have fun in this town.
Do you?
Yeah. It's good. We've been coming through, you know, every once in a while for the last 30 years. But this is probably the first time that we have actually come back so soon after another event. So I'm looking forward to it.
You're traveling motorhome, and you're traveling all over this land, I guess.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Got a big old tour bus, you know, been out there. It's 10 months a year that we're living on the road out there, so we do it right. So we do it so that it's doable.
Your father's work. I don't know what kind of relationship you have with your father or with his work, but I would hope that you are as enamored with it as anybody else.
Well, of course, I grew up, you know, when I was a kid, singing my dad's songs. And when I started, I was 13 years old and got invited up to sing on a stage, sang a few of my dad's tunes. Got so scared that I ran back and swore I would never do that again. Of course, I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah.
And in those days, a lot of people came to hear Woody's Kid, to hear Woody Guthrie songs. That's what was popular in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. No, he died at what age were you when he died?
I was 20 in 1967. He was 55.
Yeah. The songs that he does, that he put together, sang, wrote, did he write them all down, or were some of them sort of just carried orally forever until somebody else wrote them down?
No, he actually wrote many more down than we have. He was a writing fanatic, and he had a memory that was almost what we would call photographic today. So everything that anybody ever said, any place he'd ever been, anything he'd ever read, and he was an extensive reader, he was able to put in songs in ways that were so accurately portrayed that you get the feeling that you were there in the events that he's writing about.
Well, I'm thinking about Deportee when you say that.
Deportee, there's a host of songs that he wrote about historical or things that had actually happened that were not just fantasy or something. He saw himself as almost like a journalist in music because the history of people was he recognized in the 40s. That the history of people was in the songs of the disasters in the mines and in the fields and the chain gangs on the ranges and the cowboy ballads and all of that kind of stuff. These were histories that were not in the textbooks in the schools that people could read about, but they were contained in the songs that people had been handing down from generation to generation. And so he saw himself as a journalist of that ilk, that he would continue to write about the things that were going on so that people in the future would have a way of knowing who they were.
Well, he also seemed to have quite a bit of vision. The song Deportees I was talking about was written in 1947, as I recall, and it was about a plane crash, an old C-47 crash with a lot of Mexican migrant workers aboard that were being deported back to Mexico. And I think the song tells us that they were welcomed in the States to come in and do the picking, but as soon as it was over, they were herded back and taken back to Mexico. And the problem that Woody saw with the crash was the newspaper just said a bunch of deportees were killed. Didn't say anything about Juan or Rosalita or anybody personally.
Didn't mention anybody's name, and I think that in those days, you know, got to realize that in the 30s, during the Depression, the camps that were built under FDR and places like that, mm-hmm. were mostly inhabited by people from here in Kentucky or Ohio and Oklahoma and Missouri and Nebraska, and people that had lost their farms or their jobs or whatever had mostly gone to California and places like that in looking for work. The old Tom Joad story.
The old Grapes of Wrath.
They set up these camps to help house people that were otherwise homeless with their families and stuff like that while they was picking fruit or cotton, whatever it was. Well, those places during the 50s and 60s transformed into places where they, to this day, are still housing people that speak Spanish primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to with John Steinbeck's son, Tom, who's a buddy of mine, and we did some looking around at these places where I've got photographs of my dad and Steinbeck in these camps, and we took pictures of us in their places. And I'll tell you what, people were running for cover when they saw the cars coming. They didn't know if they were going to get picked up and sent back or what. As soon as they found out we were just musicians and writers hanging out, everybody came back out, and they brought us the best grapes I had ever eaten in my life.
Is that right?
Yeah.
A big fiesta then.
Yeah.
Okay, it sounds good. I lived in San Antonio for a year, 4 months, and 18 days, and I remember every one of them. I had the most beautiful experience there. I love the place. And one of the things I liked best was every week there was another fiesta. And my favorite one was Nitno. You probably never heard of it. It's not a biblical holiday. But Nitno is night in old San Antonio. But it's referred to in shorthand as Nitno.
Wow.
You going to Nitno tonight? Well, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it yet. Anyway, one of those things. How was it with Steinbeck's son? And
well, we're actually related now. His Steinbeck's son Tom is married to my son-in-law's aunt. So
it makes you third cousins, doesn't it?
Oh, I don't know what it makes us, but we became friends. And Steinbeck and my dad had a sort of odd relationship, I guess.
I wasn't aware that they had gotten together, but I can sure see why.
Well, I think what happened, at some point, my dad went to see the movie, The Grapes of Wrath, in New York City, when it first came out or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he read the book, then wrote a song. The song was 12 verses long. It was called Tom Joad, which I just recorded with my old friends, the Dillards, if you know who they are.
Yeah.
And but the song came out, and my dad got a little note from John Steinbeck, and saying something I can't actually say on the radio, but you little something or other.
Son of a?
No.
No, you little.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Four letters. Sounds like hit.
A two-syllable word that rhymes with nerd.
I see.
And you little so-and-so, he said.
Had a way with words.
How the hell can you write in 12 verses what it took me an entire novel to say?
Oh,
and it was a lovely way of complimenting the song. And so my dad went out, they met, and you know, they were both writing about the same subject, mm-hmm. at the time, which is the regular guy being stepped on and forgot about by the government at that time, and people who were in positions of business authority, you might say. And so they were working on the same ideas. So it's nice to be related now in some way.
Yeah, we think so. Steinbeck, From the Terrace, Travels with Charlie.
Yeah.
All that sort of good stuff.
Well, they've got a great museum out there now, the Steinbeck Museum, and we're trying to help them raise some money to keep up the good. You know, he's one of the only authors in the world whose books never went out of hard cover printing.
They didn't paperback it?
No, it might be, but it's still available, still being produced in hardcover. That's an amazing thing for an American writer.
I wasn't aware of that. But tell me a little bit more about the orchestral involvement. And in this case, tell me about what the orchestra members, students, think about a collaboration like this.
Well, I think for the students, it's so remarkable. And this is true for me, too, but to be able to work with Arlo, who's connected, so fundamentally connected to the American folk music and to American music. And
you can't get any closer in the connection.
Can't get any closer, and I just...
Like eating dirt.
Just, that's about it, yeah.
I don't know if it's like eating dirt, but...
Well, you know what I mean. It's sort of may not be nourishing, but it tastes good.
You know, if you could just figure a way to get compost directly to the table, you wouldn't have to go through that regrowing stage. Anyway, excuse me, John.
Oh, no, that's fine. I just think it's wonderful for the university kids and for myself to have a chance to work with somebody who's so connected to the, you know, and to become part of that process and part of that tradition and part of that history. That's just a wonderful opportunity for us.
Are the kids aware of this connection, this extremely close connection? Are they very aware of it?
That's hard to say. I'm not sure. I mean, it's something we've talked about, and I know the professors have talked about it in the classes, and you know, some of the kids have hunted up info on it, or you know, their parents will tell them about it. But even if they know it on a sort of intellectual level, they're not all sort of plugged into the visceral experience of what it means and, you know, how important it is and how interesting it is and how much they're going to learn from it. And that's something that they'll realize as they go through the process and, you know, but sort of by the time the concert's over and they've seen the whole thing at work and had a chance to work with Arlo. And, you know, the students that played on the recording a year and a half ago, they have a strong sense of what it's about.
So the real benefit of doing something like this, collaborate not just between different genres of music, but ages of people and the histories of people, the audience is going to be very varied also. And there's no way to explain away the magic that might occur or might not. But with any true performance, there's always the chance that real magic happens. That magic, it's not dependent on the music. It's not dependent on the artists. It's not dependent on any of that. It's just one of the things that may happen in a given concert situation. It's like the rest, like theater. In any performance of any kind of music, sometimes you can get so lost and forget the world, and you go into a different place. That does not depend on how old you are or how much you know or what kind of degree you got. That's just a human experience that can happen, and that leaves an imprint on you for the rest of your life. When I was a kid, about 9 or 10 years old, I went to see Olatunji, the famous African drummer, and this was, I'm 60 now, so that's a long time, 50 years ago. A few years ago, I went to Africa, and I'm sitting in this big auditorium, and Nelson Mandela's coming in, and Dalai Lama, and some all these. We were having a big conference going on, and I'm talking to somebody, and all of a sudden, I hear this guy drumming, and I said, "You know what? That sounds just like Olatunji I heard when I was a kid." And the person looks at me and says, "That is Olatunji." And I suddenly froze in time. How does somebody, 50 years after hearing a guy, recognize who he is on a drum? He's not even playing a piece that I know that are like a stringed instrument or something. There's something that can happen with an artist's spirit that comes through and rekindles a memory. That's what can happen. To young people, old people will remember something. That's the magic I'm talking about. That's what we strive to do as performers and as musicians and as conductors and directors. It's all for that.
Is that what makes it all worthwhile?
Yeah, because all it's familiar. Practice. It's not recreating a new experience. It's finding something that's so familiar that it's a part of you that wakes up as a connection to other people. And when that happens, you know, that's something you can't pay for. That's something you can't practice for. It's just going to happen or it's not. But when it does, it's worth all the places and the things you've done that have given you the opportunity to get to that moment. It's like going to Carnegie Hall. You can't practice for that. But having played there, it'll set you up for anywhere else you want to play.
That time has taken what it soon forgets. The gambler's paradise in short vignettes.
And the writing that Jamie Burton did just reached back into the soul of it and pulled it out and in ways that I would love to be able to do.
And Jamie did all the arranging for this?
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah, and the way we did this, it was a wonderful collaboration that we had. Myself and Jamie several times over the course of a couple of years traveled to Arlo's house in Massachusetts and to the old church from Alice's restaurant, and we would get together and sit around a big old table all day, all afternoon, and Arlo would get out his guitar and Jamie would sit at the piano and we'd sort of sing through the songs, and Arlo would talk about the history of the song and the mood and how it went and, you know, what the story was, and you know, somebody would say, well, it's a little bit like a Hopper landscape, you know, it ought to have that sort of empty feeling, and, you know, we'd sort of talk about that, and then somebody would say, well, you know, if we wrote some brass chorale here, or what if there was a solo string quartet, or what if the solo violinist was here, or you know, what if this piece sounded a little bit like an old Louis Armstrong chart, or, you know, what we're going after here is that 20s movie music, and we'd sort of have these long conversations and come up with conceptual ideas for how the music should be, the three of us together. Then Jamie would sit down and write out all the, you know, parts, and
he'd take it and go with it then.
Yeah, and he's just a master at that. And
is he a composer also, or is he just a master arranger? I mean, because basically you're talking about composition here.
Yeah, I mean he's...
Call it arranging if you want to, but it's...
He's not primarily a composer, but his background is he was a choir boy at Westminster Abbey and was one of England's leading countertenors. He was invited to join the King Singers, and he's now the chorus master at Oxford in England. And so
got a pretty good credential. Then,
he has good credentials, and so his, you know, his background is in writing for choir, writing arrangements and compositions for choir. But it translates really nicely into the orchestra, and he's also an orchestra conductor. He works for the Holly Orchestra in Manchester.
Now, how did you come across Jamie Burton?
I went to school with him at the Peabody Conservatory, and the way he got involved with this is when we were first starting this project, you know, before we'd ever performed a concert or anything, and we were just sort of talking about it and working on it, the guy from the Boston Pops called up for, they wanted to do Arlo with the Boston Pops on TV, and they called up and said, we want to have a gospel choir in one of the songs, and do you know any, you know, what do you think about it? I talked to Arlo, he said, yeah, that sounds good, and then the guy says, well, do you know anyone who could do the arrangement? And I said, you know, as a matter of fact, I do know a guy who could do that arrangement.
Yeah.
And then I sat down with him, we started working on it, and ended up writing the entire orchestral arrangement right on the spot overnight in his apartment at his piano. And when we, you know, then we saw how good it was, and we showed it to Arlo, and that sort of turned into Jamie working with us on all the arrangements, whether they had choir parts or not.
Mm. The writing for instruments is more difficult, less difficult, more interesting?
Well, the palette is broader. I mean, you know, the human voice, of course, is infinitely expressive, but you've got, you know, with the orchestra, you have so many different tone colors between mm-hmm. brass instruments and woodwinds, percussion, strings, and so many different combinations that mm-hmm. can be used. And the thing is there, you know, there's no right way to do it, but there are lots and lots of wrong ways to approach it, you know, and things that you can write that just don't sound good. So it really takes someone with a real ear for the sound of the orchestra and the way the, you know, the way the parts interact and the way the timbres sound together. So we got really lucky to have that collaborator on that project.
Well, it's not only that. You know, there are a lot of instances these days when you can get a pop performer or a country singer or folk singer or something like that, jazz singer, to play with an orchestra. but a lot of the arrangements are generally stuff that you could probably play on a synthesizer if you're skilled enough. It's wonderful to work with a writer who is familiar with the orchestral instruments. I mean, starting with them, not just the sounds of them, but mm-hmm. what their ranges are and what the abilities are of the players.
And the colors that John was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when what you actually get is a piece of music that's actually written for people who actually play instruments and not just for some fluffy pop stuff that you could stick on any song or take it or leave it. This is a different beast. To be able to write to come from the classical world. Mm-hmm. Because when we originally started to do this, it wasn't just the idea of getting some strings behind a song. It was really to integrate the two kinds of music, the traditional folk music that I grew up on, back porch picking, with the kinds that are written down and expressed in writing. Two totally different traditions, try to get them to work equally well together. That was the object.
Okay, where was this hatched? Where was the idea hatched?
Well, let me say one more thing about what Arlo's saying, and then we can talk about its hatching. But one of the problems you have when you're trying to put an orchestra together with a popular artist of any sort is you don't want the audience to sit there and say, you know, it doesn't really matter that the orchestra's there. You know, they're not contributing to the fabric of the music mm-hmm. in a meaningful way. So what we wanted to make sure that what we were doing was something that mattered from the orchestra part of things as well as the song part of things, and that we would be able to, you know, bring those two things together in a way that worked and didn't make either one of them not work, if you see what I'm saying.
When we first tried this thing, we had some guy write some charts for us, and I had to relearn all of my own freaking songs. I mean, I didn't know where to start. I didn't know where to end. I didn't know what verse I was singing. He had wrote them all in such crazy ways that I'm sitting, everybody else has got music up there.
A chart notation?
I didn't have a chart in front of me. They wanted me to learn 2.5 hours of music that I could do in one day. And I said, you know what, guys? This ain't going to work for me. And so we threw out all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's when Jamie Burton really came in with John and some of the other principal players that we sat down and had to write new charts that I could actually perform. Because my songs go a certain way. And to make that music work with the way they were and not take me and rewrite me.
Yeah.
That was the task that I thought was really genius in what we ended up with.
The way this came about originally was I was in New York visiting some people at the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center. And I saw as I was leaving, I saw on the poster Arlo Guthrie playing at Lincoln Center. And I had been a fan of Arlo's. My parents played him when I was a kid and things like that. So I said, I'd like to go to that, but it was sold out, and it had already started. But anyway, I snuck in during the intermission because I wanted to hear it. And I had a roommate who used to sneak into the Cleveland Orchestra every single week in Cleveland when I was at the Institute there at the intermission. He'd go smoke with the smokers and then go in and hear the second half. So anyway, I did that, and Arlo was playing his dad's song, This Land Is Your Land, and he stopped partway through the song and started talking about how his parents met. And his mother, as I was saying before, was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company. And his father, of course, was the folk singer. And he was talking about how the two met when they tried to combine, you know, the Martha Graham's dance with some of Woody's folk music.
For a performance.
Yeah. That's how his parents met. And so when he was talking about that, I started thinking about Aaron Copland and his music that he wrote for Martha Graham, which was based on these old folk songs, Appalachian Spring and the Shaker Hymn and that kind of stuff.
And the Ballet Russe, all that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. yeah.
So I was thinking about that and then thinking about Arlo's songs, and I was sort of imagining what would happen if a composer like Copland set Arlo's songs for the orchestra, but Arlo would still be singing them. You know, in other words, Arlo's voice would be part of the composition of these songs,
mm-hmm.
and it wouldn't be for, you know, an art song
tenor or whatever.
Right.
It would be for a folk singer tenor, Arlo.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the concert, I approached Arlo and started talking about the idea. And he had actually been thinking of something along the same lines, so sort of took off from there.
That's where it went from there.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys have gotten to be pretty good friends, I take it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so far so good.
So far so good. Biggest hit, Alice's Restaurant, City of New Orleans?
City of New Orleans is probably the one that went higher on the charts than anything. Alice's Restaurant, of course, was so long. Like we noted earlier, really couldn't be played on the radio much, so
take a whole lot of charts.
Yeah.
Part A,
and
part
just
B.
Never got the climb on the Billboard charts or the cash box things, you know, that City of New Orleans got. That was probably my biggest sort of success in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't write songs for shelf life. And I didn't write songs that would be popular. I just kept doing the things that I grew up doing, still doing it now. Now my kids and my grandkids are even playing. And so to get a glitch in the system like what we had with those kinds of hits or coming into Los Angeles from the Woodstock record or something like that,
mm-hmm.
for those to become popular was unlooked for. Nobody writes an 18-minute monologue to become popular on radio, I can tell you that. So, you know, I've had a wonderful run just being me without trying to become part of the entertainment industry.
City of New Orleans, Arlo, do you ever ride the train?
Well, you know.
And had you ridden train before you sang the song?
No, I learned that song from the guy that wrote it, Steve Goodman, in Chicago, 1971. And soon after that, I don't remember exactly when it was, but the Illinois Central sort of went out of business and Amtrak took over the routes and things like that. So the opportunity to do it was gone. Until about a year ago, and after the Katrina disaster, I was trying to find some way to help out aside from sending money to the Red Cross or something, and I got the idea of taking the City of New Orleans, which Amtrak had renamed one of their trains, the City of New Orleans, and I thought, let's take that from Chicago down to the Gulf, do about a few stops here and there, do some fundraisers, get some instruments and some cash, see what we could do to help the musicians down
to
there.
Take the instruments to New Orleans to
yes.
the musicians who lost their instruments.
That's right.
Yeah,
and the money, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we did in 3 weeks what normally should have taken a year. We put 8 shows together. We started selling tickets and doing that and getting the artists, and it all came about because I had the idea, and I sent an email to my 4 kids who all work with me in the music thing, and I said, "Kids, what do you think of that?" Within 20 minutes, I'm not making this up, of sending that email, I got an email from Richard Pryor, who I'd never met, but obviously, you know, I love the guy, and I knew he was sick, and he said, "Arlo, this is Richard Pryor. This is a great idea. I want to support it. I'll sponsor the first show you do." And
really?
I said, "Yeah," and I said, "Whoa. This isn't, you know." And then 24 hours after I sent out that email, I got a phone call from Willie Nelson saying, "Arlo, if there's something I can do, let me know." And he was the other one that had the hit with this song, as well as John Denver. I also sang City of New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so I knew this was getting real. And then within 3 weeks, we were on that train in Chicago, sitting. The folks at Amtrak had got out the original Illinois Central cars, put them on the back of an Amtrak train, and they put us on it with 30 other musicians and friends, family, and like that.
And you played your way south.
We played our way south. We raised, like I said, about $150,000 in cash, more than 50 pianos and organs and keyboards, horns, guitars, amplifiers, all that kind of stuff. and tried to make some kind of a difference down there.
Mm.
And the great thing was, like you said, I had never been on that train. The Illinois Central was long gone, but I was sitting there with my wife, and my three daughters were sitting on the floor in the, you know, in front of me. Those seats are far apart. And we pulled out of the station in Chicago, and one of my daughters looked up and said, "Pop, do you know what we're doing?" I said, "What are we doing?" She said, "We're riding on the city of New Orleans." And everybody's got teary-eyed, and it was great because they had grown up with the song. But to make that come alive and be in a real moment, it changed everybody's life. You know what? It was a song that on Charlie Chaplin's 100th birthday, I get a mail with the lyrics to this song in it, asking me if I would want to. They were doing a compilation trying to get a number of artists to record some Chaplin music. And I looked at the lyrics. I said, "Well, how does this go?" And they sent me a recorded version of some Chaplin music that where the words had never been put to it. The lyrics went with it, but nobody had ever put them together. Mm. And I started singing this song. I was, in those days, we were visiting hospitals and other places where people were, you know, dealing with life and death issues. And one of the songs that they loved hearing was this song. And when I had a chance to record it with the orchestra, that was one of the first ones I took to Jamie, and I said, "Look, we've got to get an arrangement of this song because nobody's ever recorded it before. It's been sitting there for who knows how many years. He's born 100 years ago, but so maybe for the last 50 years or more, 75 years, these lyrics and this music has not ever been put together." And so we had a chance to do that, and I think it's just terrific.
You are the song.
That was Archival Curtains at 8 from November 2007, with Nick Lawrence, Arlo Guthrie, the maestro John Nardalillo, and former Lexington Mayor Jim Newberry. I'm Joshua Baer, and thank you very much for listening to 91.3 WUKY. Take care.